He is running against incumbent Ben Carpenter, who was elected in 2018. Ben did not submit any biographical information to the Alaska Department of Elections. But we can tell you he graduated from Nikiski High School in 1993. He joined the U.S. Army and also served in the Alaska Army National Guard. He is a peony farmer and was president of the Alaska Peony Market Cooperative. Given the state of Alaska's budget deficit and now the coronavirus pandemic, it has been a turbulent last couple years in the legislature. So why are you running to do this all again?
Well, the easy answer to that is I feel like there's unfinished business. 2 years ago, or you know, my first election 2 years ago, was I felt a calling to come and help with setting the state on a better financial direction, and we haven't done that yet. And I really feel like I'm still called to do that. I'm still having fun, although it's a challenge. I do feel like we do need to spend our time giving back to the community and serving in some capacity, and this is what I feel like I'm called to do.
So budget, obviously a pretty big topic to tackle, but before we get into that, are there other issues that you would like another shot at?
One of the things that I learned in my first two sessions is that the legislature has a tendency to be very myopic and not long-term focused. And so I would like to, as much as I can influence the conversation down there, help move the conversation into a long-term vision or long-term thinking. I don't think that just solving the problem short-term is going to... Like the saying says, if you want to know where you want to be in 10 years, then you got to do something now to start you moving in that direction. But if you don't know where you're going to be in 10 years, or you don't know where you want to be in 10 years, anything we do now will get us there. And so the big picture, just having that conversation and having other people in the room that believe in setting some kind of goal for us for 10 years and building upon that by what we do now is something that needs to happen at the legislature. And that's not any one particular thing. That's just a philosophy or a thinking pattern that needs to happen there at the legislature. And I think that's what the people are expecting, but it just isn't happening that way. My political philosophy tells me that we have unfinished business with the concept of abortion. And I have a philosophical problem with spending money on eliminating pregnancies when there's plenty of families out there who want to adopt children. And I think it is morally questionable for us to have state policies that say we would rather kill our babies than adopt them out. So I think there's some room for improvement there. And that's one of the things that we weren't able to get to. So outside of finance, right? The other thing that we were able to get to last session, actually the first session that I was in, was the repeal and replacement of Senate Bill 91 that was overwhelmingly supported by the public to get rid of that monster.
And that's the crime.
That's the crime bill. The crime bill that was somewhat related to finances, but
right.
But not. I mean, it was.
In that sense, everything is related to finances, of course.
Exactly.
But yeah.
But you know, when it comes to domestic violence, we've got room for improvement there. We have very high rates of domestic violence with against women and children in this state. And I think that we should look at toughening up our laws for people who are perpetrators who engage in domestic violence. I think that is necessary. I think it is also necessary for us to improve our economy, because a lot of the stress that happens within families, within the domestic environment, is brought on by not having wages, not having a good job. And that financial stress impacts a family. I mean, that's part of the challenge that we have. You can't just put people in jail and expect that that's the only thing that you need to do to improve domestic violence. We do have to address the lack of jobs and lack of opportunity for people. So we need a growing economy, and that comes full circle to what right. we do with the budget and, yes. and what we do with finances at the state level.
Certainly cannot get away from finances and the budget. So to maybe flesh out those topics a little bit on the more financial end. So domestic violence, for instance, public safety, of course, mm-hmm. that's one of those areas that we have to fund as a state. You've, you know, spoken pretty forcefully about needing to live within our means. Is that an area that you would see needing to or having room to cut more, or is that an area that you think more resources could go into?
I don't currently have the numbers on what the increase has been since we passed repealed the Senate Bill 91 and replaced it, but I do know that we've had an increase in the population, prison population,
right,
and thus requires additional cost. So I'm not looking to reduce spending in either of those two areas. What I would encourage the role of the legislator within the, you know, interacting with the bureaucracy is to ask good questions. Where are you finding efficiencies? Since last time we talked, where have you been able to find efficiencies to reduce the cost to the taxpayer? And where do you see that those efficiencies are you able to gain going into the future, right? There's always room for improvement in every organization.
Okay. And then circling back to the abortion issue as well, from a kind of financial standpoint, you're saying you'd like to prohibit any state funds mm-hmm. supporting that. Where are you seeing those funds being spent now? Often what you hear on that issue is it's more a federal level issue than a state level issue. So what state funds are you seeing spent or going to support abortions that you would like to stop?
Thank you. The federal issue being largely the elephant in the room is Roe versus Wade. There's some expectation that maybe the Supreme Court's going to take that up again. And if that changes, then the issue then comes back to the states to figure out what the solution is. So you potentially would have 50 different solutions being a state's rights issue or a state issue to solve. Right now it's not. It's been elevated to the federal level and one law covers all 50 states. So assuming that things change in that regard and the state now can have a determination of its policies, then obviously the first step would be our funds, right? Our state funds, taxpayer funds, don't go to support organizations who provide abortion services. I'm of the opinion that if we call some sort of organism on Mars life and we're searching for that, why can't we call an organism that is growing and has a heartbeat inside a human being? Why can't we call that life? And if it is life, why do our policies allow us to eliminate it, to kill it? I believe that's a moral component to our existence. And so I would support an elimination of medical practice, the medical practice of providing abortion, elective abortion. Now, obviously, there's health of the mother issues that between the mother and the doctor, you can't trade one life for another. That doesn't make sense to me. But using abortion as birth control or because the child is inconvenient is not an appropriate thing for our state for our people to put as a law.
Fisheries, obviously another pretty important issue here on the Kenai Peninsula, and the legislature doesn't have a ton of direct involvement in, you know, managing fisheries and managing runs and whatnot. But one of the things you can do is confirm the governor's appointments to the Board of Fish, yep. and his last crop of appointees raised controversy with some of those folks. So in general, are you happy with the makeup of the board? You know, one of the things you hear is whether or not it's representative of different types of fishing, different user groups, different regions of the state. Would you like to see a different makeup of that board, or do you kind of feel like the governor has the right to appoint who he would like to appoint?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and it's an age-old question that we've been dealing with here on the Kenai for quite a while. My district in particular is made up of both constituencies, from the far east to the far west, Cook Inlet to Seward. We've got a number of commercial fishermen and commercial guides and sport fishermen. So there's a wide sampling of people that this impacts. What has been frustrating to me, having dove into this process here relatively late, being elected 2 years ago, we have a conflict happening over a resource. The Constitution tells us that we need to manage the resources of a state for the benefit of all. And that's kind of paraphrasing, but that's what the Constitution is requiring. It's focused on managing of the resource. And we have two competing interests, largely, that this war is over, this fish wars are over, right? You've got a commercial fishing interest that is financially tied to the resource. And then you've got a tourism-based commercial sport fishing industry that's cropped up. And those two are vying for the resource, for their share of the resource. So the question then is, how do we best manage those? And those aren't the only two, right? So we've got personal use, dip netters coming in, and those who want to go take a rod and down to the river and catch their fish and bring it home and put it in the freezer. You've got the personal use issue that's going on.
And certainly subsistence as well. There's some of that on the Kenai Peninsula, but
absolutely
more of that elsewhere in the state.
Right. And so your personal use and your subsistence, in my mind, are the priority. That's the people who are using the resource to feed their families. And that becomes a priority in my mind. The financial interest over the resource is a secondary thing. But again, we go back to everything's about finances. And if we've got commercial fishermen who are doing well, and we've got professional guides that are doing well, that's money into our economy. And both of that goes away if we mismanage the resource, right? So that benefit of our financial benefit in our economy goes away if we mismanage the resource. If one, as we're seeing now, and I would tend to agree that we're seeing a pendulum swing, that we've got commercial fishermen that have, for whatever reason, haven't had very good fishing years. Not because the fish aren't there, but because policies put in place previously have eliminated them from, or prevented them from fishing. So I think the pendulum has swung a little too far. I would love to see a system set up so that we don't have the volatility, the political volatility, with the management of the resource. I don't know exactly what that answer is, but I think it lies with empowering biologists, people who are using science to make decisions, as opposed to unelected or appointed bureaucrats on a board. That may be the best thing that we've got going right now. It's broken, though. So it needs to be fixed. And I think the people need to understand that it's not. So we hear the sport fishing versus commercial fishing, and the first thing people think of is, hey, I like taking my rod down and catching sport fish, right? But that's not the whole problem. That's kind of just skimming the surface of the problem. The problem is two commercial interests vying for that resource. And when you look at it in that light, then you have to say, okay, we've got commercial interests, we've got subsistence and private interest, right? That's sport, that's dip netting, but we have to recognize that we've got two commercial interests vying for that resource, and how are we going to fairly manage that resource so that both of those commercial interests get a fair shake at the resource? And I honestly think that that's not the case right now.
That is Representative Ben Carpenter, the incumbent for House District 29 in the Alaska State Legislature. This is the Kenai Conversation on KDLL Kenai Soldotna 91.9 FM. I'm Jenny Nyman. So moving on to the big one, of course, which is the budget. So how do we chart a course forward where we're not continuing to draw down the admittedly dwindling reserves that we have?
Yeah. So I like to break this up into two separate questions. One of them is short-term, one of them is long-term.
Okay.
Okay. So if we want to have a balanced budget in a decade, there are a couple of things now that will add stability to that process. And if we've been listening to the business community over the last, I don't know how many years, they've been requesting some stability and predictability in our budgeting process. So I think there's two things that need to be done. One of them is improve our constitutional spending limit. Right now we have a constitutional spending limit. It is ineffective because we are spending way less than where that limit is at. Our budget would be somewhere north of $10 billion if we were actually bumping up against that limit. So it's ineffective. We've got to figure out a way to force the legislature each year to have a conversation about limiting the spending and in a way that gives stability, meaning it isn't up to the legislature each year to decide how much they're going to spend. There is a stability factor built in that says, no, you, the people only agree to this amount of spending. And obviously it's got to increase because inflation increases. There's got to be some factor there to, for the reality of increase of costs over time. And also a caveat for emergencies and things like that. The other thing is the permanent fund dividend is a major instability factor. Businesses, individuals, government are all waiting to see how the politics shake out and what is going to be the solution each year for the permanent fund dividend. And that adds instability into that process. So putting the solution to the how we spend the permanent fund earnings into the Constitution so that it takes that off the table. We just do it because that's how the Constitution says, that's how the people, because the people would have to vote on that constitutional amendment. The people have said, this is how we want the permanent fund earnings to be managed. Right now, the legislature can ignore the laws that are on the book because there's nobody to enforce whether the legislature does or not. The only enforcement is at the ballot box. In reality, as long as there's a majority of the legislators who want to ignore a law, then they can do that.
And you've been in favor of a full statutory PFD, correct?
I have, okay. Yes, because it's part of the law. And I also tend to believe that the benefit to our economy from the permanent fund earnings being spent in the private sector is the best way to use the permanent fund earnings. The goal is 10 years from now, we need to have a stable spending plan. And putting the permanent fund dividend, solving that problem by putting it in the Constitution is going to help stabilize the conversation. It doesn't do anything for the short term, right? So that's the second problem that we have is the short term. Then the question then becomes, what do we do with spending and taxation, revenue generation? So then the question becomes simpler. What do we want to spend our money on and where are we going to get the money? Obviously, you've got federal dollars running in. You've got potentially money coming in from the earnings if that's the way that we want to choose to do that. And then if we don't have enough money and we say we want to continue spending, then we have to raise taxes to do it. There's just another alternative. So that brings us to the short-term problem, which is how do we solve this budget deficit as it is today? And I think that that's the easier problem to solve, right? From an outside perspective, if you're looking at it purely from an economist's perspective that's outside the state, maybe from somebody in another state that doesn't have a permanent fund, they would look at our finances and say, what's the big deal? You've got a lot of cash on hand, right? So our budget deficit this year is the easiest thing to solve. We've got money in DGF accounts or designated fund.
Thank you.
Of the general fund. Mm-hmm. So that's money that's set aside, that's earning interest, and it is being used every year, appropriated every year, the earnings from those accounts for specific purposes. So there's a couple $1 billion in those accounts that could be used for balancing the budget. The only other real pool of money that we have is in the earnings reserve account, or the ERA, that is only there. That money exists and has been earning interest only because we have not paid permanent fund dividend checks according to the statutory formula over the last 5 years, 6 years, since Governor Walker vetoed the first appropriation, and that money stayed in the earnings reserve account. So that money is there that is has the ability to be spent by the legislature by a simple majority.
So you're saying use those to get us through this coming year?
Well, that's the only option we have. Either of those two funds is pretty much all we've got. We've got a little bit of money left over in the CBR, or the Constitutional Budget Reserve.
Nowhere near the
And frankly, it's not money that we can spend. We would force the state to go into deal with the operating costs of the state in a different manner. So you would have to take out short-term loans or something like that to do the operating costs. So we need to keep about the $500 million mark level in the CBR for the state's operating costs. And that's about where we're going to be at this next session. So there's, practically speaking, nothing in the CBR. And this is frustrating to me, and it goes back to problem number one, which is putting a long-term vision out for the budget. We spent the money down, we spent all of our CBR, but we've never solved the underlying problem, which is plaguing us today. So we're at a crossroads where if we don't solve the problem, all of our accessible money will be gone that we can balance a budget with. It'll be gone, and then we'll have no more options. besides going in debt to pay for government and or increasing taxes or something like that. And taxes, we can levy a tax, but it doesn't come into effect until the next year. It's a longer term, maybe interim or medium term solution. And right now we're going to have a conversation about what kind of taxes do we want to raise. So
taxes do we want to raise, or perhaps tax structures, of course, that we might want to change. I mean, ballot measure one is obviously a big issue this go around too. And is that an area that you would see making some changes to perhaps increase what the state makes off of those resources? And if so, are you a fan of ballot measure one, or would you like to see that done differently?
Good question. And I can tie it into the long-term vision piece, right? So if we need to have a growing economy, anything we do today that jeopardizes a growing economy is a thing that we should not do. So I'm an opponent of Prop 1. I think it would damage our economy in the long term and for limited short-term gain. So we had heard that we were going to get $1 billion. If we just pass this initiative, we'll have an additional $1 billion. But those projections are wildly inaccurate, and we're looking at less than half of that. It would help, obviously, but it would be a short-term gain. And we would see an economic, the byproduct of that conversation would, or that action would be a downturn in our economy. Likewise, instituting a large income tax or a large sales tax are also going to have a negative impact to the local economy. Taking the permanent fund dividend out of the local economy has a negative impact to our private sector economy. The reality is the size of our state budget, when compared to other states of the same population size and similar economic output, is too large. And so we're having to reorder how we think about revenue in this state. Looking out a decade from now, we're not going to be known as an oil state. We'll still have oil revenue, but it won't be the largest portion of revenue in the state. Our investment earnings will be. Our permanent fund, if managed appropriately, will be somewhere near $100 billion. Financial services, or having the investment interest earned off of that pool of money, is going to be the biggest player in our budgeting process and our state politics. So we've got to figure out now how we're going to deal with that going into the future, and recognize that that's where we're going to be headed. Now, there is some negative consequence to reducing state spending, and I recognize that less state spending means fewer state workers. Fewer state workers means fewer groceries being bought at the store, fewer cars being bought. And so there's a downturn or a negative impact to the economy as well. But the state doesn't generate wealth. So that money had to come from somewhere. It came from the private sector in every single case. So not reducing state spending has a longer term negative impact than increasing a tax at this point to cover the deficit that we have. Because we'll never be able to continue to increase the amount of revenue to match that state spending increase without harming our economy every single time we do so. Long term, that's a better option than continuing to add on taxes to pay for an ever-increasing and bloated, I would say, but larger state budget than what we actually can afford under the economy that we have and the number of people that we have. I think all of the above is something that we're going to have to consider.
Are there new revenue generation measures that you would support then?
If I had to, if I could get agreement to reduce the budget in a significant manner and it took instituting a sales tax to do so, then I would be okay with that. That's something that I think, listening to the public, I think that would be acceptable.
Okay.
I would be even more happy to say we need a short-term tax increase and have that sunset out in a period where our investment earnings are now take that place and we don't need it anymore.
So as far as reductions to the budget then, what areas do you see being able to sustain that? I mean, there's obviously some things the state is constitutionally required to spend on, of course, and there are levels associated with that. But yep. Where do you see cuts being able to be made?
I'd much rather look at it as where do we find efficiencies? So the problem is we've got two departments that are the lion's share of the spending that we do within the state, and that's education and health and social services.
Right.
Okay. So we can address cuts in all of the other departments and not touch those two, and we won't be able to solve the problem. I think it's appropriate for our state university system to take a look at what the size of our population is, the size of our economy, and say, are we properly sized to be able to support ourselves? And I think if we're honestly answering that, the answer is no, we're too big. We've got three separate universities. We've got room for improvement. I think it's crazy that we have three separate overheads, three separate administrative monsters, if you will. When the state needs a functioning university, we need a very well-functioning university system. But we don't need three functioning university systems. That's a nice thing to have when we have lots of oil money. We don't have lots of oil money anymore. Recognize that we're spread across. It's a large geographical state, and so there's a need to have multiple campuses, in my mind. But we don't need to have the large overhead of three different organizations.
Okay. So you mentioned education. Obviously, mm-hmm. university system is a component of that. K-12 education is the other big component of that. Do you see cuts being made to K-12 education as well?
I think we've got to take a look at the foundation formula and evaluate it and make changes to the foundation formula that'll more adequately reflect where our education system needs to be. If there's one silver lining in the COVID-19 issue this year, it's shown us that we can do something different in the K-12 education than what we have been doing over the last decade or so. We've got a constitutional requirement to provide public education. We don't have to have the public education system that we have currently. We can have an alternative to it. We can have multiple alternatives. The silver lining that I'm talking about within the COVID crisis is that more parents are now involved in their child's education than ever before. And now we can have a conversation that says, you know what, you may not want to do this, or you may want to do this into the future. So some families have found that, hey, that actually works for us. So we are never going to get to a place, and I'm not even attempting to even think that we would need to get to a place where we don't need brick and mortar schools. We will forever will need brick and mortar schools. But the system and the way that we fund it doesn't have to work the way that we have it working right now. And we're finding that out as we look at, in the Kenai Peninsula Borough, the Connections Program, we're looking at alternatives such as Aurora Borealis School, the charter school system.
Right? Yes.
That's been around for a while.
Yep.
That was the word that I couldn't remember here, the charter
school
system. Kaleidoscope,
Soldotna, yep, Montessori, exactly. Got a lot of charters.
You've got outside of the Kenai Peninsula School District, you've got other homeschool programs.
Idea.
Right, those, exactly. Yep. So there's a whole bunch of options out there. And we ought to be looking at what's selling from a business perspective. Look at what's popular. Look at what's selling. What are parents flocking to because it's meeting their needs? If it's not the brick and mortar school system, if it's not the way we've been doing education for decades, well, then maybe we ought to look at what the parents are actually wanting. We've got a path forward then to solve the problem that we have. I think if you give parents control and responsibility over education, they will find an efficient way to do education. And I think we will find an ability to reduce funding, but still have the same quality of education. It just won't look the same as it has looked, and that's okay.
And the other big area of state spending that you mentioned is social services, yeah. Health and social services. Where do you see reductions being possible within there?
This is not just a question that can be solved at the state level, because it's dealing with decisions that were made in the past regarding Medicaid. And so we're looking at Medicaid expansion that happened a number of years ago. We could afford it then, but we can't afford it now. So in my mind, this is a states' rights issue. But we can't just solve it by ourselves, right? I firmly believe that we will not be able to sustain the Medicaid spending going into the future, and we have got to find a way, with or without the federal government's help, to bring down the cost of healthcare. And this is not just me talking. This is all over the nation. People are complaining about the high costs of healthcare. And I firmly believe that whenever government gets involved, things get more expensive. And it's no different in healthcare. So we're going to have to talk about doing something different with our healthcare than what we're currently doing. And it has to include a reduction in what we're spending in Medicaid. The federal government is preventing us from removing people from the rolls, even if they're no longer eligible. Or the state determines that we need to reduce some services, the federal government says no. And this is what we found out when Governor Dunleavy made some reductions last budget cycle. The federal government came back and said, no, you can't do that.
That bill ended up coming due.
Right. And so the reality is, if we can't afford it because we don't have the economy, the economy, private sector economy, or the population size to afford the cost of that portion of government, we've got to be able to go to the federal government and say, hey, this worked for us in the past, but it's not working for us now. We need a different alternative.
Is there anything else that you hope voters know about you when they go to the polls?
Yeah, I think we've had a fairly broad conversation here, wide-ranging conversation. You know, there's probably one other thing that I think economically is valid. It's a proven fact that societies or cultures who have a strong agricultural foundation weather the upheavals of economic uncertainty or declines better than others that don't have an agricultural foundation. We send $2 billion out of state every year for our food. What would our state, our local boroughs and cities look like if a portion of that $2 billion stayed in our local area because we paid the farmer in the local area for that food? That's generating wealth within our state and keeping that wealth within our state. So if we can get back to a larger agricultural footprint within our state and keep that money within our state, our local governments would see a benefit, and our local communities would see a benefit for it. And that's not something that the state has to do. That's what the people have to do. We have to make a decision that we're going to start growing our food, and we're going to not send money out of state. We're going to keep it local. We're going to keep it within the state. And if we were able to cut that $2 billion down every year, then in a decade, we would be in a better position financially and health-wise, because local food is going to be healthier for us than we would if we continue to do things the way that we're doing now. Again, the reasoning behind why we're shipping in food from out of state is because we had lots of oil money and it was far cheaper to just order it out. Well, as we do know in our families, we can eat out every night if we've got lots of money. But if we don't, then we've got to do something different and be a little bit more efficient with our money. So it's up to the people. If we want to see our economy change, one way that we can do it without having government tell us we have to or some special program is by growing more of our own food. And when you do that, you decrease your dependence on out-of-state food and you keep that money local. So, that's to the extent that the state can promote that type of activity.
Right. I mean, there's the Alaska Grown program and things of that nature.
Yeah. I we're never going to be able to compete with climates that are more conducive to growing. But I took a trip over compliments of the Alaska Army National Guard. I think it was in 2016, had duty over in South Korea. I spent 2 weeks over there, and I traveled from the Seoul Metropolitan Complex down Central Peninsula to a Rock Army base. And as far as the eye could see, that two-hour trip outside of the metropolitan areas was rice paddies or fields, greenhouses, and high tunnels. North Korea has a cool climate. They get cold in the wintertime, and they have invested in their infrastructure to be able to extend their growing season for whatever crops they're growing inside these structures. Why we don't have those in the state of Alaska is a question of the will and long-term vision of our people. If we want to have better food and we want to have a better economic stability within our own economies, then we need to invest in agriculture. And it doesn't have to be something the state says you have to do this. That's a decision that we make individually, and we grow our own food. And we figure out a way to pool that food and send it to the farmer's market, or with enough capacity, sell it in the grocery stores. Start small and grow out. And in a decade, we will be in a better place than we are now, because we have better food and we don't send the money out of state. That wealth stays here.
Okay. Anything else that you would want to add?
I don't think so. I think people can get a hold of me. They can go to my Facebook page and leave me a message, or they can send me an email, ben@carpenterforhouse.com. They can call me, 690-6599, and I'd love to have the conversation.
All right.
Thanks for the questions, and I appreciate the opportunity.
And that was Ben Carpenter, the incumbent for House District 29, running against challenger Paul Dale. This has been the Kenai Conversation on listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL, Kenai Soldotna, 91.9 FM. I'm Jenny Nyman. Thanks for tuning in, and please don't forget to vote.